"We will not leave an enemy alive behind us," Heafstog roared, and several other kings cried out their agreement.
"No, of course not," said de Bernazon. "But it will not take many men to defeat Tourmaline when the boats are out. Let King Halfdane and the tribe of the Bear sack the town, while the rest of the force, led by yourself and King Beorc, presses on to Bryn Shander. The fires of the burning town should bring the entire fleet, even the ships from the other towns of Mare de Walden, into Tourmaline, where King Halfdane can destroy them on the docks. It is important that we keep them away from the stronghold of Targos. The people of Bryn Shander will receive no aid from the other lakes in time to support them, and will have to stand alone against your charge. The tribe of the Elk will flank around the base of the hill below the city and cut off any possible escape or any last-minute reinforcements."
Drizzt watched closely as de Bernazon described this second division of the barbarian forces on his map. Already the drow's calculating mind was formulating initial defense plans. Bryn Shander's hill wasn't very high, but its base was thick, and the barbarians who were to swing around the back of the hill would be a long way from the main force. A long way from reinforcements.
"The city will fall before sunset," de Bernazon declared triumphantly, "and your men will feast on the finest booty in all of Ten Towns."
A sudden cheer went up on cue from the seated kings at the southerners' declaration of victory. Drizzt put his back to the tent and considered what he had heard. This dark-haired man named de Bernazon knew the towns well and understood their strength and weaknesses. If Bryn Shander fell, no organized resistance could be formed to drive off the invaders. Indeed, once they held the fortified city, the barbarians would be able to strike at their leisure at any of the other towns.
"Again you have shown me your worth,"
Drizzt heard Heafstog tell the southerner, and the ensuing of conversations told the drow that the plans had been accepted as final. Drizzt then focused his keen senses on the encampment around him, seeking the best path for his escape. He noticed suddenly that two guards were walking his way and talking, though they were too far away for their human eyes to see him as anything but a shadow on the side of the tent. He knew that any movement on his part would surely alert them. Acting immediately, Drizzt dropped the black figurine to the ground.
"Guinevar," he called softly, "come to me, my shadow."
Somewhere in a corner of the vast astral plane, the entity of the panther moved in sudden, subtle steps as it stalked the entity of the deer. The beasts of this natural world had played out this scenario countless times, following the harmonious order that guided the lives of their descendants. The panther crouched low for the final spring, sensing the sweetness of the upcoming kill. This strike was the harmony of natural order, the purpose of the panther's existence, and the meat its reward. It stopped at once, though, when it heard the call of its true name, compelled above other directives to heed the call of its master. The great cat spirit rushed down the long, darkened corridor that marked the void between the planes, seeking the solitary speck of light that was its life on the material plane. And then it was beside the dark elf, its soulmate and master, crouching in the shadows by the hanging skins of a human dwelling. It understood the urgency of its master's call and quickly opened its mind to the drow's instructions. The two barbarian guards approached cautiously, trying to make out the dark forms that stood beside their king's tent. Suddenly, Guinevar sprang toward them and soared in a mighty leap past their drawn swords. The guards swung the weapons futilely and charged off after the cat, screaming an alert to the rest of the camp. In the excitement of the diversion, Drizzt moved calmly and stealthily away in a different direction. He heard the shouts of alarm as Guinevar darted through the campsites of the sleeping warriors and couldn't help but smile when the cat crossed through one particular group. Upon sighting this feline, who moved with so much grace and speed that it appeared as no more than a cat spirit, the tribe of the tiger, instead of giving chase, fell to their knees and raised their hands and voices in thanks to Tempus. Drizzt had little trouble escaping the perimeter of the camp, as all of the sentries were rushing off in the direction of the commotion. When the drow gained the blackness of the open tundra, he turned south toward Kelvin's cairn and sped off across the lonely plain in full flight,
all the while concentrating on finalizing a deadly counterplan of defense. The stars told him that there were less than 3 hours left before dawn, and he knew that he mustn't be late for his meeting with Brunner if the ambush were to be properly set. The noise of the surprised barbarian soon died away, except for the prayers of the tribe of the tiger, which would continue until dawn. A few minutes later, Guinevere was trotting easily by Drizzt's side. 100 times you have saved my life, trusted friend, Drizzt said, as he patted the great cat's muscled neck. 100 times and more.
They've been arguing and scuffling for 2 days now, Brunner remarked disgustedly. A blessing it is that the greater enemy has finally arrived.
Better to name the coming of barbarians in a different way, Drizzt replied, though a smile had found its way onto his normally stoic features. He knew that his plan was solid, and that the battle this day would belong to the people of 10 towns. Go now, and lay the trap. You've not much time.
We began loading the women, folk, and children onto the boats as soon as Rumblebelly told us your news, Brunner explained. We'll chase the vermin from our borders before the day is through.
The dwarf spread his feet wide in his customary battle stance and banged his axe onto his shield to emphasize his point.
You've a good eye for battle, elf. Your plan'll turn the surprise on the barbarians, and it still splits the glory evenly among them that needs glory.
Even Kemp of Targos should be pleased, Drizzt agreed. Brunner clapped his friend on the arm and turned to leave.
You'll fight beside me, then?
He asked over his shoulder, though he already knew the answer. As it should be, Drizzt assured him.
And the cat?
Guinevere has already played its part in this battle, replied the drow. I'll be sending my friend home soon. Brunner was pleased with the answer. He didn't trust the drow's strange beast.
It ain't natural, he said to himself as he tracked down Bremen's run toward the gathered hosts of 10 towns.
Brunner was too far away for Drizzt to make out his final words, but the drow knew the dwarf well enough to gather the general meaning of his grumblings. He understood the uneasiness that Brunner and many others felt around the mystical cat. Magic was a prominent part of the underworld of his people, a necessary fact of their everyday existence, but it was much rarer and less understood among the common folk of the surface. Dwarves in particular were usually uncomfortable with it, except for the crafted magical weapons and armor they often made themselves. The drow, though, had no anxiety around Guinevere from the very first day he had met the cat. The figurine had belonged to Massage Hanet, a drow of high standing in a prominent family of the great city of Menzo Berenzon, a gift from a demon lord in exchange for some assistance that Massage had given him in a matter concerning some troublesome gnomes. Drizzt and the cat had crossed paths many times over the years in the Dark City, often in planned meetings. They shared an empathy with each other that transcended the relationship that the cat felt with its then-master. Guinevere had even rescued Drizzt from certain death uncalled for, as if the cat had been watching protectively over the drow who was not yet its master. Drizzt had struck out alone from Menzo Berenzon on a journey to a neighboring city when he fell prey to a cave-fisher, a crab-like denizen of the dark caverns that customarily found a niche high above the floor of a tunnel and dropped an invisible sticky line of webbing. Like an angler, this cave-fisher had waited, and like a fish, Drizzt had fallen into its trap. The sticky line entangled him completely, rendering him helpless as he was dragged up the side of the corridor's stone wall. He saw no hope for surviving this encounter, and vividly understood that a terrible death certainly awaited him. But then Guinevere had arrived, leaping among the broken clefts and ridges along the wall at the same level as the monster. Without any regard to its own safety and following no orders, the cat charged right in on the fisher, knocking it from its perch. The monster, seeking only its own safety, tried to scramble away, but Guinevere pounced upon it vindictively, as if to punish it for attacking Drizzt. Both the drow and the cat knew from that day on that they were destined to run together. Yet the cat had no power to disobey the will of its master, and Drizzt had no right to claim the figurine from Massage, especially since the House of Hanet was much more powerful than Drizzt's own family in the structured hierarchy of the underworld. And so, the drow and the cat continued their casual relationship as distant comrades. Soon after, though, came an incident that Drizzt could not ignore. Guinevere was often taken on raids with Massage, whether against enemy drow houses or other denizens of the underworld. The cat normally carried out its orders efficiently, thrilled to aid its master in battle. On one particular raid, though, against a clan of Zwerfnebli, the deep-mining, unassuming gnomes that often had the misfortune of running up against the drow in their common habitat, Massage went too far in his maliciousness. After the initial assault on the clan, the surviving gnomes scattered down the many corridors of their maze-work mines. The raid had been successful, the treasures that had been sought were taken, and the clan had been dispatched, obviously never to bother the drow again. But Massage wanted more blood. He used Guinevere, the proud, majestic hunter, as his instrument of murder. He sent the cat after the fleeing gnomes one by one until they were all destroyed. Drizzt and several other drow witnessed the spectacle. The others, in their characteristic vileness, thought it great sport, but Drizzt found himself absolutely disgusted. Furthermore, he recognized the humiliation painfully etched on the proud cat's features. Guinevere was a hunter, not an assassin, and to use it in such a role was criminally degrading, to say nothing of the horrors that Massage was inflicting upon the innocent gnomes. This was actually the final outrage in a long line of outrages which Drizzt could no longer bear. He had always known that he was unlike his kin in many ways, though he had many times feared that he would prove to be more akin to them than he believed. Yet he was rarely passionless, considering the death of another more important than the mere sport it represented to the vast majority of drow. He couldn't label it, for he had never come across a word in the drow language that spoke of such a trait. But to the surface dwellers that later came to know Drizzt, it was called conscience. One day, the very next 10 day, Drizzt managed to catch Massage alone outside the cluttered grounds of Menzo Berenzon. He knew that there could be no turning back once the fatal blow had been struck, but he didn't even hesitate, slipping his scimitar through the ribs of his unsuspecting victim. That was the only time in his life that he had ever killed one of his own race, an act that thoroughly revolted him despite his feelings toward his people. Then he took the figurine and fled, meaning only to find another of the countless dark holes in the vast underworld to make his home, but eventually winding up on the surface. And then, unaccepted and persecuted for his heritage in city after city in the populated south, he had made his way to the wilderness frontier of Ten Towns, a melting pot of outcasts, the last outpost of humanity where he was at least tolerated. He didn't care much about the shunning he usually received, even here. He had found friendship with the halfling and the dwarves and Brunner's adopted daughter, Catty Bree. And he had Guinevere by his side. He patted the great cat's muscled neck once again and left Bremen's Run to find a dark hole where he could rest before the battle.
8. Bloody Fields.
The horde entered the mouth of Bremen's Run just before midday. They longed to announce their glorious charge with a song of war, but they understood that a certain degree of stealth was vital to the ultimate success of de Bernazon's battle plan. De Bernazon was comforted by the familiar sight of sails dotting the waters of Mare de Walton as he jogged beside King Halfdane. The surprise would be complete, he believed. And then, with ironic amusement, he noted that some of the ships already flew the red flags of the catch.
"More wealth for the victors," he hissed under his breath.
The barbarians had still not begun their song when the tribe of the bear split away from the main group and headed toward Tourmaline, though the cloud of dust that followed their run would have told a wary observer that something out of the ordinary was happening. They rolled on toward Bryn Shander and cried out their first cheer when the pennant of the principal city came into sight. The combined forces of the four towns of Mare de Walden lay hidden in Tourmaline. Their goal was to strike fast and hard at the small tribe that attacked the city, overrunning them as quickly as possible, then charge to the aid of Bryn Shander trapping the rest of the horde between the two armies. Kemp of Targos was in command of this operation, but he had conceded the first blow to a Gorwal, spokesman of the home city. Torches set the first buildings of the city ablaze as Halfdane's wild army rushed in. Termalane was second only to Targos among the 9 fishing villages in population, but it was a sprawling, uncluttered town with houses spread out over a large area and wide avenues running between them. Its people had retained their privacy and a measure of breathing room, giving the town an air of solitude that belied its numbers. Still, de Bernazon sensed that the streets seemed unusually deserted. He mentioned his concern to the barbarian king at his side, though Halfdane assured him that the rats had gone into hiding at the approach of the bear.
"Pull them out of their holes and burn their houses," the barbarian king roared. "Let the fishermen on the lake hear the cries of their women and see the smoke of their burning town."
But then an arrow thudded into Halfdane's chest, burying itself deep within his flesh and biting through, tearing into his heart. The shocked barbarian looked down in horror at the vibrating shaft, though he couldn't even utter a final cry before the blackness of death closed in around him. With his ashwood bow, a Gorwal of Termalane had silenced the king of the tribe of the bear, and on signal from a Gorwal strike, the 4 armies of Mayor Dualden sprang to life. They leaped from the rooftops of every building, from the alleys and doorways of every street. Against the ferocious assault of the multitude, the confused and stunned barbarians realized immediately that their battle would soon be at an end. Many were cut down before they could even ready their weapons. Some of the battle-hardened invaders managed to form into small groups, but the people of 10 towns, fighting for their homes and the lives of their loved ones, and armed with crafted weapons and shields forged by dwarven smiths, pressed in immediately. Fearlessly, the defenders bore the remaining invaders down under the weight of their greater numbers. In an alley on the edge of Termalane, Regis dived behind the concealment of a small cart as 2 fleeing barbarians passed by. The halfling fought with a personal dilemma. He didn't want to be labeled a coward, but he had no intention of jumping into the battle of big folk. When the danger had passed, he walked back around the cart and tried to figure out his next move. Suddenly, a dark-haired man, a member of 10 Towns Militia, Regis supposed, entered the alley and spotted the halfling. Regis knew that his little game of hiding was over. The time had come for him to make his stand.
2 of the scum just passed this way," he called boldly to the dark-haired southerner. "Come, if we're quick, we can catch them yet."
De Bernazon had different plans, though. In a desperate attempt to save his own life, he had decided to slip down one alley and emerge from another as a member of the 10 Towns force. He had no intention of leaving any witnesses to his treachery. Steadily, he walked toward Regis, his slender sword at the ready. Regis sensed that the mannerisms of the closing man weren't quite right.
"Who are you?"
he asked, though he somehow expected no reply. He thought that he knew nearly everyone in the city, though he didn't believe that he had ever seen this man before. Already he had the uncomfortable suspicion that this was the traitor Drizzt had described to Brunner.
"How come I didn't see you come in with the others early?"
De Bernazon thrust his sword at the halfling's eye. Regis, dexterous and ever alert, managed to lurch out of the way, though the blade scratched the side of his head and the momentum of his dodge sent him spinning to the ground. With an unemotional, disturbingly cold-blooded calm, the dark-haired man closed in again. Regis scrambled to his feet and backed away, step for step with his assailant, but then he bumped up against the side of the small cart. De Bernazon advanced methodically. The halfling had nowhere left to run. Desperate, Regis pulled the ruby pendant from under his waistcoat.
"Please don't kill me,"
he pleaded, holding the sparkling stone out by its chain and letting it dance seductively.
"If you let me live, I'll give you this and show you where you can find many more."
Regis was encouraged by de Bernazon's slight hesitation at the sight of the stone.
"Surely it's a beautiful cut and worth a dragon's hoard of gold."
De Bernazon kept his sword out in front of him, but Regis counted as the seconds passed and the dark-haired man did not blink. The halfling's left hand began to steady, while his right, concealed behind his back, clasped firmly onto the handle of the small but heavy mace crafted for him personally by Brunner.
"Come, look closer,"
Regis suggested softly. The Bernazon, firmly under the spell of the sparkling stone, stooped low to better examine its fascinating dance of light.
"This isn't really fair,"
Regis lamented aloud, confident that de Bernazon was oblivious to anything he might say at that moment. He cracked the spiked ball of the mace onto the back of the bending man's head. Regis eyed the result of his dirty work and shrugged absently. He had done only what was necessary. The sounds of the battle in the street rang closer to his alley sanctuary and dispelled his contemplation. Again the halfling acted on instinct. He crawled under the body of his felled enemy, then twisted around underneath to make it look as if he had gone down under the weight of the larger man. When he inspected the damage of de Bernazon's initial thrust, he was glad that he hadn't lost an ear. He hoped that his wound was serious enough to give credence to this image of a death struggle. The main host of the barbarian force reached the long low hill that led up to Bryn Shander, unaware of what had befallen their comrades in Tourmaline. Here they split again, with Hiefstag leading the tribe of the elk around the eastern side of the hill, and Beorg taking the rest of the horde straight toward the walled city. Now they took up their song of battle, hoping to further unnerve the shocked and terrified people of Ten Towns. But behind the wall of Bryn Shander was a very different scene than the barbarians imagined. The army of the city, along with the forces of Kaer Koenig and Kaer Dinneval, sat ready with bows and spears and buckets of hot oil. In a dark twist of irony, the tribe of the elk, out of sight of the front wall of the city, took up a cheer when the first screams of death rang out on the hill, thinking the victims to be the unprepared people of Ten Towns. A few seconds later, as Hiefstag led his men around the easternmost bend in the hill, they too met with disaster. The armies of Goodmead and Dugan's Hole were firmly dug in and waiting, and the barbarians were hard-pressed before they even knew what had hit them. After the first few moments of confusion, though, Hiefstag managed to regain control of the situation. These warriors had been through many battles together, seasoned fighting men who knew no fear. Even with the losses of the initial attack, they were not outnumbered by the force before them, and Hiefstag was confident that he could overrun the fishermen quickly and still get his men into position. But then, shouting as they came, the army of Easthaven charged down the Eastway and pressed the barbarians on their left flank. And Hiefstag, still unshaken, had just ordered his men to make the proper adjustments to protect against the new foe, when 90 battle-hardened and heavily armored dwarves tore into them from behind. The grim-faced dwarven host attacked in a wedge formation with Brunner as its deadly tip. They cut into the tribe of the elk, felling barbarians like a low-swinging scythe through tall grass. The barbarians fought bravely, and many fishermen died on the eastern slopes of Bryn Shander. But the tribe of the elk was outnumbered and outflanked, and barbarian blood ran freer than the blood of their foes. Hiefstag worked wildly to rally his men, but all semblance of formation and order disintegrated around him. To his worst horror and disgrace, the giant king realized that every one of his warriors would die on this field if they didn't find a way to escape the ring of enemies and flee back to the safety of the tundra. Hiefstag himself, who had never before retreated in battle, led the desperate break. He and as many warriors as he could gather together rushed around the dwarven host, seeking a route between them and the army of Easthaven. Most of the tribesmen were cut down by the blades of Brunner's people, but some managed to break free of the ring and bolt away toward Kelvin's cairn. Hiefstag got through the gauntlet, killing two dwarves as he passed, but suddenly the giant king was engulfed in an impenetrable globe of absolute darkness. He dived headlong through it and emerged back into the light, only to find himself face to face with a dark elf. Brunner had 7 notches to put on his axe handle, and he bore down on number 8, a tall, gangly barbarian youth, too young even to show any stubble on his tanned face, but bearing the standard of the tribe of the elk with the composure of an experienced warrior. Brunner curiously considered the engaging stare and calm visage as he closed in on the youth. It surprised him that he did not find the savage fire of barbarian bloodlust contorting the youth's features, but rather an observant, understanding depth. The dwarf found himself truly lamenting having to kill one so young and unusual, and his pity caused him to hesitate slightly as the two joined battle. Ferocious as his heritage dictated, though, the youth showed no fear, and Brunner's hesitation had given him the first swing. With deadly accuracy, he slammed his standard pole down onto his foe, snapping it in half. The amazingly powerful blow dented Brunner's helm and jolted the dwarf into a short bounce. Tough as the mountain stone he mined, Brunner put his hands on his hips and glared up at the barbarian, who nearly dropped his weapon, so shocked was he that the dwarf still stood.
"Silly boy," Brunner growled as he cut the youth's legs out from under him. "Ain't ye never been told not to hit a dwarf on the head?"
The youth desperately tried to regain his footing, but Brunner slammed an iron shield into his face.
"Eight!" roared the dwarf as he stormed away in search of number nine.
But he looked back for a moment over his shoulder to consider the fallen youth, shaking his head at the waist of one so tall and straight, with intelligent eyes to match his physical prowess, a combination uncommon among the wild and ferocious natives of Icewind Dale. Heafstog's rage doubled when he recognized his newest opponent as a drow elf.
"Sorceress dog!" he bellowed, raising his huge axe high into the sky. Even as he spoke, Drizzt flicked a finger and purple flames limbed the tall barbarian from head to toe.
Heafstog roared in horror at the magical fire, though the flames did not burn his skin. Drizzt bore in, his two scimitars whirling and jabbing, thrusting high and low too quickly for the barbarian king to deflect both. Blood trickled from many small wounds, but Heafstog seemed able to shake off the punctures of the slender scimitars as no more than a discomfort. The great axe arced down, and though Drizzt was able to deflect its path, the effort numbed his arm. Again the barbarian swung his axe. This time Drizzt was able to spin out of its killing sweep, and the completion of the drow's rotation left the overbalanced Heafstog stumbling and open to a counter. Drizzt didn't hesitate, driving one of his blades deep into the barbarian king's side. Heafstog howled in agony and launched a backhand swing in retaliation. Drizzt thought his last thrust to be fatal, and his surprise was total when the flat head of Heafstog's axe smashed into his ribs and launched him through the air. The barbarian charged quickly after, meaning to finish this dangerous opponent before he could regain his footing. But Drizzt was as nimble as a cat. He landed in a roll and came up to meet Heafstog's charge with one of his scimitars firmly set. His axe helplessly poised above his head, the surprised barbarian couldn't stop his momentum before he impaled his belly on the wicked point. Still he glared at the drow and began to swing his axe. Already convinced of the superhuman strength of the barbarian, Drizzt had kept up his guard this time. He knifed his second blade just under the first, opening the lower part of Heafstog's abdomen from hip to hip. Heafstog's axe fell harmlessly to the ground as he grabbed at the wound, desperately trying to keep his belly from spilling out. His huge head lolled from side to side, the world spun about him, and he felt himself endlessly falling. Several other tribesmen, in full flight and with dwarves hot on their heels, came by at that moment and caught their king before he hit the ground. So great was their dedication to Heafstog, the two of them lifted him and carried him away while the others turned to face the coming tide of dwarves, knowing that they would certainly be cut down, but hoping only to give their comrades enough time to bear their king to safety. Drizzt rolled away from the barbarians and leaped to his feet, meaning to give chase to the two who bore Heafstog. He had a sickening feeling that the terrible king would survive even the last grievous wounds, and he was determined to finish the job. But when he rose, he too found the world spinning. The side of his cloak was stained with his own blood, and he suddenly found it difficult to catch his breath. The blazing midday sun burned into his night eyes, and he was lathered in sweat. Drizzt collapsed into darkness. The three armies waiting behind Bryn Shander's wall had quickly dispatched the first line of invaders and then driven the remaining barbarian host halfway back down the hill. Undaunted and thinking that time would play in their favor, the ferocious horde had regrouped around Beorg and begun a steady, cautious march back toward the city. When the barbarians heard the charge coming up the eastern slope, they assumed that Heafstog had finished his battle on the side of the hill, had learned of the resistance at the front gate, and was returning to help them smash into the city. Then Beorg spotted tribesmen fleeing to the north toward Icewind Pass, the stretch of ground opposite Bremen's Run that passed between Lac Dinashir and the western side of Kelvin's Cairn. The king of the tribe of the wolf knew that his people were in trouble. offering no explanation beyond the promised thrust of the tip of his spear to any who questioned his orders, Beorg started to turn his men around to head away from the city, hoping to regroup with Halfdane and the tribe of the Bear and salvage as many of his people as he could. Before he had even completed the reversal of the march, he found Kemp and the four armies of Mayor Dewalden behind him, their deep ranks barely thinned by the slaughter in Tourmaline. Over the wall came the armies of Bryn Shander, Caer Conig, and Caer Dinnaval, and around the hill came Brunner, leading the Dwarven clan and the last three armies of Ten Towns. Beorg ordered his men into a tight circle.
"Tempest is watching," he yelled at them. "Make him proud of his people!"
Nearly 800 barbarians remained, and they fought with a confidence of the blessing of their god. They held their formation for almost an hour, singing and dying, before the lines broke down and chaos erupted. Less than 50 escaped with their lives. After the final blows had at last been swung, the exhausted warriors of Ten Towns set about the grim task of sorting out their losses. More than 500 of their companions had been killed, and 200 more would eventually die of their wounds. Yet the toll wasn't heavy, considering the 2,000 barbarians who lay dead in the streets of Tourmaline and on the slopes of Bryn Shander. Many heroes had been made that day, and Brunner, though anxious to get back to the eastern battlefields to search for missing companions, paused for a long moment as the last of them was carried in glory up the hill to Bryn Shander.
"Rumblebelly!" exclaimed the dwarf.
"The name is Regis,"
the halfling retorted from his high perch, proudly folding his arms across his chest.
"Respect, good dwarf," said one of the men carrying Regis. "In single combat, spokesman Regis of Lonelywood slew the traitor that brought the horde upon us, though he was wickedly injured in the battle."
Brunner snorted in amusement as the procession passed.
"There's more to that tale than what's been told, I'll wager," he chuckled to his equally amused companions. "Or I'm a bearded gnome."
Kemp of Targus and one of his lieutenants were the first to come upon the fallen form of Drizzt Do'Urden. Kemp prodded the dark elf with the toe of his blood-stained boot, drawing a semi-conscious groan in response.
"He lives,"
Kemp said to his lieutenant with an amused smile.
"A pity!"
He kicked the injured drow again, this time with more enthusiasm. The other man laughed in approval and lifted his own foot to join in the fun. Suddenly, a mailed fist slammed into Kemp's kidney with enough force to carry the spokesman over Drizzt and send him bouncing down the long decline of the hill. His lieutenant whirled around, conveniently ducking low to receive Brunner's second swing square in the face.
"One for yourself, too!"
the enraged dwarf growled as he felt the man's nose shatter under his blow. Cassius of Bryn Shander, viewing the incident from higher up on the hill, screamed in anger and rushed down the slope toward Brunner.
"You should be taught some diplomacy," he scolded.
"Stand where you are, son of a swamp pig," was Brunner's threatening response. "Ye owe the drow your stinking lives and homes," he roared to all around him who could hear him, "and ye treat him as vermin."
"Wear your words, dwarf,"
retorted Cassius, tentatively grabbing at his sword hilt. The dwarves formed a line around their leader, and Cassius's men gathered around him. Then a third voice sounded clearly.
"Wear your own, Cassius," warned a Gorwell of Tourmaline. "I would have done the same thing to Kemp if I was possessed of the courage of the dwarf."
He pointed to the north.
"The sky is clear," he yelled. "Yet were it not for the drow, it would be filled with the smoke of burning Tourmaline."
The spokesman from Tourmaline and his companions moved over to join Brunner's line. Two of the men gently lifted Drizzt from the ground.
"Fear not for your friend, valiant dwarf," said a Gorwell. "He will be well tended in my city. Never again shall I or my fellow men of Tourmaline prejudge him by the color of his skin and the reputation of his kin."
Cassius was outraged.
"Remove your soldiers from the grounds of Bryn Shander," he screamed at a Gorwell.
But it was an empty threat, for the men of Tourmaline were already departing. Satisfied that the drow was in safe hands, Brunner and his clan moved on to search the rest of the battlefield.
"I'll not forget this,"
Kemp yelled at him from far down the hill. Brunner spat at the spokesman from Targos and continued on unshaken. And so it went, that the alliance of the people of 10 towns lasted only as long as their common enemy. Epilogue. All along the hill, the fishermen of 10 towns moved among their fallen enemies, looting the barbarians of what small wealth they possessed and putting the sword to the unfortunate ones who were not quite dead. Yet amid the carnage of the bloody scene, a finger of mercy was to be found. A man from Goodmead rolled the limp form of an unconscious young barbarian over onto its back, preparing to finish the job with his dagger. Brunner came upon them then, and recognizing the youth as the standard-bearer who had dented his helmet, stayed the fisherman's thrust.
"Don't kill him! He's nothing but a boy, and he can't have known truly what he and his people did!"
"Bah!" huffed the fisherman. "What mercy would these dogs have shown to our children, I ask you? He's half in the grave anyway!"
"Still I ask ye to let him be!"
Brunner growled, his axe bouncing impatiently against his shoulder.
"In fact, I insist!"
The fisherman returned the dwarf's scowl, but he had witnessed Brunner's proficiency in battle and thought the better of pushing him too far. With a disgusted sigh, he headed off around the hill to find less protected victims. The boy stirred on the grass and moaned.
"So, ye've a bit of life left in ye yet," said Brunner.
He knelt beside the lad's head and lifted it by the hair to meet his eyes.
"Hear me well, boy. I saved your life here. Why, I'm not quite known. But don't ye think ye've been pardoned by the people of 10 towns? I want ye to see the misery your people have brung. Maybe killing is in your blood, and if it is, then let the fisherman's blade end ye here and now. But I'm feeling there's more to ye, and ye'll have the time to show me right. You're to serve me and me people in our mines for 5 years and a day to prove yourself worthy of life and freedom."
Brunner saw that the youth had slumped back into unconsciousness.
"Never mind," he muttered. "You'll hear me well before all's done, be sure of that."
He moved to drop the head back to the grass, but laid it down gently instead. Onlookers to the spectacle of the gruff dwarf showing kindness to the barbarian youth were indeed startled, but none could guess the implications of what they had witnessed. Brunner himself, for all of his assumptions of this barbarian's character, could not have foreseen that this boy, Wulfgar, would grow into the man who would reshape this harsh region of the tundra. Far to the south, in a wide pass among the towering peaks of the spine of the world, Akkar Kessel languished in the soft life that Crenshinabon had provided for him. His goblin slaves had captured yet another female from a merchant caravan for him to play with, but now something else had caught his eye. Smoke, rising into the empty sky from the direction of 10 towns.
"Barbarians," Kessel guessed.
He had heard rumors that the tribes were gathering when he and the wizards from Luskin had been visiting Easthaven. But it didn't matter to him, and why should it? He had all that he needed right here in Kryshal Tirith, and had no desire to travel anywhere else. No desires that were wrought of his own will. Crenshinabon was a relic that was truly alive in its magic, and part of its life was the desire to conquer and command. The crystal shard was not content with an existence in a desolate mountain range where the only servants were lowly goblins. It wanted more. It wanted power. Kessel's own subconscious recollections of 10 towns when he had spotted the column of smoke had stirred the relic's hunger, so it now used the same emphatic power of suggestion on Kessel. A sudden image grasped at the wizard's deepest needs. He saw himself seated on a throne in Bryn Shander, immeasurably wealthy and respected by all in his court. He imagined the response from the host tower of the Arcane in Luskin when the mages there, especially Eldaluk and Dendibar, learned of Akkar Kessel, lord of 10 towns and ruler of all Icewind Dale. Would they offer him a robe in their puny order then? Despite Kessel's true enjoyment of the leisurely existence he had found, the thought appealed to him. He let his mind continue through the fantasy, exploring the paths that he might take to accomplish such an ambitious goal. He ruled out trying to dominate the fisher folk as he had dominated this goblin tribe, for even the least intelligent of the goblins had held out against his imposing will for quite a long time. And when any of these had gotten away from the immediate area of the tower, they regained their ability to determine their own actions and had fled into the mountains. No, simple domination would not work against the humans. Kessel pondered using the power that he felt pulsing within the structure of Kryshal Tirith, destructive forces beyond anything he had ever heard of, even in the host tower. This would help, but it wouldn't be enough. Even the strength of Crenshinabon was limited, requiring lengths of time under the sun to gather new power to replace expended energy. Furthermore, in 10 towns there were too many people, too widely scattered to be corralled by a single sphere of influence, and Kessel didn't want to destroy them all. Goblins were convenient, but the wizard longed to have humans bowing before him, real men, like the ones who had persecuted him for all of his life. For all of his life before he had gained the shard. His ponderings eventually led him inevitably down the same line of reasoning. He would need an army. He considered the goblins he presently commanded, fanatically devoted to his every wish. They would gladly die for him. In fact, several had. Yet even they weren't nearly numerous enough to engulf the wide region of the Three Lakes with any semblance of strength. And then an evil thought, again covertly insinuated into his will by the crystal shard, came upon the wizard.
"How many holes and caves," Kessel cried aloud, "are there in this vast and rugged mountain range? And how many goblins, ogres, even trolls and giants do they harbor?"
The beginnings of a devious vision took shape in his mind. He saw himself at the head of a huge goblin and giant army, sweeping across the plains, unstoppable and irresistible. How he would make men tremble! He lay back on a soft pillow and called for the new harem girl. He had another game in mind, one that had also come to him in a strange dream. It called for her to beg and whimper, and finally, to die. The wizard decided, though, that he would certainly consider the possibilities of lordship over 10 towns that had opened wide before him. But there was no need to hurry. He had time. The goblins could always find him another plaything. Crenshinabon, too, seemed to be at peace. It had placed the seed within Kessel's mind, a seed that it knew would germinate into a plan of conquest. But like Kessel, the relic had no need for haste. The crystal shard had waited 10,000 years to return to life and see this opportunity of power flicker again. It could wait a few more. Part 2. Wulfgar. Tradition. The very sound of the word invokes a sense of gravity and solemnity. Tradition. Su'u's chalk, in the drow language. And there, too, as in every language that I have heard, the word rolls off of one's tongue with tremendous weight and power. Tradition. It is the root of who we are, the link to our heritage, the reminder that we as a people, if not individually, will span the ages. To many people in many societies, tradition is the source of structure and of law. The abiding fact of identity that denies the contrary claims of the outlaw or the misbehavior of the rogue. It is that echoing sound deep in our hearts and our minds and our souls that reminds us of who we are by reinforcing who we were. To many, it is even more than the law. It is the religion, guiding faith as it guides morality and society. To many, tradition is a god itself. The ancient rituals and holy texts scribbled on unreadable parchments yellowed with age or chiseled into eternal rocks. To many, tradition is all. Personally, I view it as a double-edged sword, and one that can cut even more deeply in the way of error. I saw the workings of tradition in Menzo Berenzon, the ritualistic sacrifice of the third male child, which was almost my own fate,
the workings of the three drow schools. Tradition justified my sister's advances toward me in the graduation of Mele Magvir, and denied me any claims against that wretched ceremony. Tradition holds the matrons in power, limiting the ascent of any males. Even the vicious wars of Menzo Baranzon, house against house, are rooted in tradition, are justified because that is the way it has always been. Such failings are not exclusive to the drow. Often I sit on the northern face of Kelvin's cairn, looking out over the empty tundra and the twinkling lights of the campfires in the vast barbarian encampments. There, too, is a people wholly consumed by tradition, a people clinging to ancient codes and ways that once allowed them to survive as a society in an inhospitable land, but that now hinder them as much as, or more than, help them. The barbarians of Icewind Dale follow the caribou herd from one end of the dale to the other. In days long past, that was the only way they could have survived up here. But how much easier might their existence be now if they only traded with the folk of Ten Towns, offering pelts and good meat in exchange for stronger materials brought up from the south so they might construct more permanent homes for themselves. In days long past, before any real civilization crept this far to the north, the barbarians refused to speak with or even to accept anyone else within Icewind Dale, the various tribes often joining for the sole purpose of driving out any intruders. In those past times, any newcomers would inevitably become rivals for the meager food and other scarce supplies, and so such xenophobia was necessary for basic survival. The folk of Ten Towns, with their advanced fishing techniques and their rich trade with Luskin, are not rivals of the barbarians. Most have never even eaten venison, I would guess. And yet, tradition demands of the barbarians that they do not make friends with those folk, and indeed, often war upon them. Tradition. What gravity indeed does that word impart? What power it wields! As it roots us and grounds us and gives us hope for who we are because of who we were, so it also wreaks destruction and denies change. I would never pretend to understand another people well enough to demand that they change their traditions. Yet how foolish it seems to me to hold fast and unyieldingly to those mores and ways without regard for any changes that have taken place in the world about us. For that world is a changing place, moved by advancements in technology and magic, by the rise and fall of populations, even by the blending of races, as in the half-elf communities. The world is not static. And if the roots of our perceptions, traditions, hold static, then we are doomed, I say, into destructive dogma. Then we fall upon the darker blade of that double-edged sword. Drizzt, Doerden. 9. No more a boy. Regis stretched out lazily against his favorite tree and enjoyed a drawn-out yawn, his cherubic dimples beaming in the bright ray of sunlight that somehow found its way to him through the thickly packed branches. His fishing pole stood poised beside him, though its hook had long since been cleaned of any bait. Regis rarely caught any fish, but he prided himself on never wasting more than one worm. He had come out here every day since his return to Lonelywood. He wintered in Bryn Shander now, enjoying the company of his good friend Cassius. The city on the hill didn't compare to Kalimport, but the palace of its spokesman was the closest thing to luxury in all of Icewind Dale. Regis thought himself quite clever for persuading Cassius to invite him to spend the harsh winters there. A cool breeze wafted in off Mare Dualden, drawing a contented sigh from the halfling. Though Kythorn had already passed its midpoint, this was the first hot day of the short season, and Regis was determined to make the most of it. For the first time in over a year he had been out before noon, and he planned to stay in this spot, stripped of his clothes, letting the sun sink its warmth into every inch of his body until the last red glow of sunset.
An angry shout out on the lake caught his attention. He lifted his head and half-opened one heavy eyelid. The first thing he noticed, to his complete satisfaction, was that his belly had grown considerably over the winter, and from this angle, lying flat on his back, he could see only the tips of his toes. Halfway across the water, four boats, two from Tourmaline and two from Targo's, jockeyed for position, running past each other with sudden tacks and turns, their sailors cursing and spitting at the boats that flew the flag of the other city. For the last 4.5 years, since the Battle of Bryn Shander, the two cities had virtually been at war. Though their battles were more often fought with words and fists than weapons, more than one ship had been rammed or driven into rocks or up to the beach in shallow waters. Regis shrugged helplessly and dropped his head back to his folded waistcoat. Nothing had changed much around 10 towns in the last few years. Regis and some of the other spokesmen had entertained high hopes of a united community, despite the heated argument after the battle between Kemp of Targos and Agorwal of Tourmaline over the drow. Even on the banks of the lake across the way, the period of goodwill was short-lived among the long-standing rivals. The truce between Caer Dinnaval and Caer Conig had lasted only until the first time one of Caer Dinnaval's boats landed a valuable and rare 5-footer on the stretch of Lac Dinashir that Caer Conig had relinquished to her as compensation for the waters she had lost to Easthaven's expanding fleet. Furthermore, Good Mead and Dugan's Hole, the normally unassuming and fiercely independent towns on the southernmost lake, Redwaters, had boldly demanded compensation from Bryn Shander and Tourmaline. They had suffered staggering casualties in the battle on Bryn Shander's slopes, though they had never even considered the affair their business. They reasoned that the two towns which had gained the most from the united effort should be made to pay. The northern cities, of course, balked at the demand. And so the lesson of the benefits of unification had gone unheeded. The 10 communities remained as divided as ever before. In truth, the town which had benefited the most from the battle was Lonelywood. The population of 10 towns as a whole had remained fairly constant. Many fortune hunters or hiding scoundrels continued to filter into the region, but an equal number were killed or grew disenchanted with the brutal conditions and returned to the more hospitable south. Lonelywood, though, had grown considerably. Mare Dualden, with its consistent yield of knucklehead, remained the most profitable of the lakes, and with the fighting between Tourmaline and Targos, and Braemyn precariously perched on the banks of the unpredictable and often flooding Shaingarn River, Lonelywood appeared the most appealing of the 4 towns. The people of the small community had even launched a campaign to draw newcomers, citing Lonelywood as the home of the halfling hero, and as the only place with shade trees within 100 miles. Regis had given up his position as spokesman shortly after the battle, a choice mutually arrived at by himself and the townsfolk. With Lonelywood growing into greater prominence and shaking off its reputation as a melting pot of rogues, the town needed a more aggressive person to sit on the council, and Regis simply didn't want to be bothered with the responsibility anymore. Of course, Regis had found a way to turn his fame into profit. Every new settler in the town had to pay out a share of his first catches in return for the right to fly Lonelywood's flag, and Regis had persuaded the new spokesman and the other leaders of the town that since his name had been used to help bring in the new settlers, he should be cut in for a portion of these fees. The halfling wore a broad smile whenever he considered his good fortune. He spent his days in peace, coming and going at his leisure, mostly just lying against the moss of his favorite tree, putting a line in the water once and letting the day pass him by. His life had taken a comfortable turn, though the only work he ever did now was carving scrimshaw. His crafted pieces carried 10 times their old value, the price partially inflated by the halfling's small degree of fame, but more so because he had persuaded some connoisseurs who were visiting Bryn Shander that his unique style and cut gave his scrimshaw a special artistic and aesthetic worth. Regis patted the ruby pendant that rested on his bare chest. It seemed that he could persuade almost anyone of almost anything these days. The hammer clanged down on the glowing metal,
Sparks leaped off the anvil platform in a fiery arc, then died into the dimness of the stone chamber. The heavy hammer swung again and again, guided effortlessly by a huge, muscled arm. The smith wore only a pair of pants and a leather apron tied about his waist in the small, hot chamber. Black lines of soot had settled into the muscular grooves across his broad shoulders and chest, and he glistened with sweat in the orange glow of the forge. His movements were marked by such rhythmic, tireless ease that they seemed almost preternatural, as though he were the god who had forged the world in the days before mortal man. An approving grin spread across his face when he felt the rigidity of the iron finally give a bit under the force of his blows. Never before had he felt such strength in the metal. It tested him to the limits of his own resilience, and he felt a shiver as alluring as the thrill of battle when he had at last proven himself the stronger.
Brunner will be pleased.
Wulfgar stopped for a moment and considered the implications of his thoughts, smiling in spite of himself as he remembered his first days in the mines of the dwarves. What a stubborn, angry youth he had been then, cheated out of his right to die on the field of honor by a grumbling dwarf who justified unasked-for compassion by labeling it good business. This was his fifth and final spring indentured to the dwarves, in tunnels that kept his 7-foot frame continually hunched. He longed for the freedom of the open tundra, where he could stretch his arms up high to the warmth of the sun or to the intangible pull of the moon. Or lie flat on his back with his legs unbent, the ceaseless wind tickling him with its chill bite, and the crystalline stars filling his mind with mystical visions of unknown horizons. And yet, for all of their inconveniences, Wulfgar had to admit that he would miss the hot draughts and constant clatter of the dwarven halls. He had clung to the brutal code of his people, which defined capture as disgrace, during the first year of his servitude, reciting the Song of Tempest as a litany of strength against the insinuation of weakness in the company of the soft, civilized southerners. Yet Brunner was as solid as the metal he pounded. The dwarf openly professed no love for battle, but he swung his notched axe with deadly accuracy and shrugged off blows that would fell an ogre. The dwarf had been an enigma to Wulfgar in the early days of their relationship. The young barbarian was compelled to grant Brunner a degree of respect, for Brunner had bested him on the field of honor. Even then, with the battle lines firmly defining the two as enemies, Wulfgar had recognized a genuine and deeply rooted affection in the eyes of the dwarf that had confused him. He and his people had come to pillage 10 towns, yet Brunner's underlying attitude seemed more the concern of a stern father than the callous perspective of a slave's master. Wulfgar always remembered his rank in the mines, however, for Brunner was often gruff and insulting, working Wulfgar at menial, sometimes degrading tasks. Wulfgar's anger had dissipated over the long months. He came to accept his penance with stoicism, heeding Brunner's commands without question or complaint. Gradually, conditions had improved. Brunner had taught him to work the forge, and later, to craft the metal into fine weapons and tools. And finally, on a day that Wulfgar would never forget, he had been given his own forge and anvil, where he could work in solitude and without supervision, though Brunner often stuck his head in to grumble over an inexact strike or to spout a few pointers. More than the degree of freedom, though, the small workshop had restored Wulfgar's pride. Since the first time he lifted the smithy hammer he called his own, the methodical stoicism of a servant had been replaced by the eagerness and meticulous devotion of a true craftsman. The barbarian found himself fretting over the smallest burr, sometimes reworking an entire piece to correct a slight imperfection. Wulfgar was pleased about this change in his perspective, viewing it as an attribute that might serve him well in the future, though he didn't as yet understand how. Brunner called it character. The work paid dividends physically as well. Chopping stone and pounding metal had corded the barbarian's muscles, redefining the gangly frame of his youth into a hardened girth of unrivaled strength. And he possessed great stamina, for the tempo of the tireless dwarves had strengthened his heart and stretched his lungs to new limits. Wulfgar bit his lip in shame as he vividly remembered his first conscious thought after the Battle of Bryn Shander. He had vowed to pay Brunner back in blood as soon as he had fulfilled the terms of his indenture. He understood now, to his own amazement, that he had become a better man under the tutelage of Brunner Battlehammer, and the mere thought of raising a weapon against the dwarf sickened him. He turned his sudden emotion into motion, slamming his hammer against the iron, flattening its incredibly hard head more and more into the semblance of a blade. This piece would make a fine sword. Brunner would be pleased.
10. The Gathering Gloom. Torga the Orc faced Grok the Goblin with open contempt. Their respective tribes had been warring for many years, as long as any living member of either group could remember. They shared a valley in the spine of the world and competed for ground and food with the brutality indicative of their warlike races. And now they stood on common ground with no weapons drawn, compelled to this spot by a force even greater than their hatred for each other. In any other place, at any other time, the tribes could never have been this close without joining in fierce battle. But now, they had to be content with idle threats and dangerous glares, for they had been commanded to put aside their differences. Torga and Grok turned and walked, side by side, to the structure that held the man who would be their master. They entered Kryshal Tirith and stood before Akar Kessel. Two more tribes had joined his swelling ranks. All about the plateau that harbored his tower were the standards of various bands of goblins. The goblins of twisting spears, slasher orcs, the orcs of the severed tongue, and many others all come to serve the master. Kessel had even pulled in a large clan of ogres, a handful of trolls, and 20 rogue Verbeeg, the least of the giants, but giants nonetheless. But his crowning achievement was a group of frost giants that had simply wandered in, desiring only to please the wielder of Kren Shinabon. Kessel had been quite content with his life in Kryshal Tirith, with all of his whims obediently served by the first tribe of goblins that he had encountered. The goblins had even been able to raid a trading caravan and supply the wizard with a few human women for his pleasures. Kessel's life had been soft and easy, just the way that he liked it. But Kren Shinabon was not contented. The relic's hunger for power was insatiable. It would settle for small gains for a short time, and then demand that its wielder move on to greater conquests. It wouldn't openly oppose Kessel, for in their constant war of wills, Kessel ultimately held the power of decision.